I'm Sherry.
And I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Sherry.
First, I would like to thank Billy for asking me to speak here. Last time I came, we were talking at dinner, and oh, thank you, Rick and Justine and Dee and Chuck. They met Tamla and I for dinner beforehand, and it's y'all are great people. But the last time I was here, I think it was almost 2 years ago, came with my sponsor who spoke. So it's always nice to be asked back somewhere. Usually in my alcoholism, no one wanted to see me anywhere. I'll get the logistics out of the way. My sobriety date is November the 20th, 2007. My home group is in Richmond, Virginia, and it's also a speaker meeting, and it just finished meeting. It meets at 5 o'clock, Keystone Group, 5 to 6 on Sunday evenings. So if you are ever in Richmond and you want to hear a speaker, several of y'all have been and given us the privilege of your story, come and see us. We are always welcome. Y'all are always welcome to come and see. Now, I'll tell you, I brought this with me. I got this. This is called the AA Speaker's Manual. So don't fear. I read this quickly on the way up. So, but really what this is, I just got back from Akron, Ohio. I went on the AA history tour. I just got back a couple weeks ago. I'm a big history nerd. And as my story will reveal, that I would have anything to do with Alcoholics Anonymous is a miracle in itself. But for me to actually go to the birthplace of AA and be able to see, you know, the place where Bill and Bob met, and to walk through Dr. Bob's home and to go through the archives, which is where this came from, was a very moving experience. And I don't think it's really sank in. You know, it was very spiritual. But I picked this up at the intergroup office because, you know, my home group's a speaker meeting. And the first thing that stuck out for me right after the foreword was, it says, be brief. It doesn't just say be brief twice. It says be brief 7 times all the way through. So I don't know how well I'll adhere to what our founders want us to do for speaking. But it was originally printed in 1942 to help people that were giving their first talk. So right off the bat, they said be brief. So I will tell you, you know, as y'all read from page 29, what my job up here is to tell you how I have developed my relationship with God. And I do that. I tell you what it was like for me, and I'll tell you what happened to me and what it's like now in my life. You know, God was always around me, always. I just chose to set it aside and ignore it and rely, and you'll see, rely on my own intelligence, what I thought it was, my big, beautiful brain. And I say that. I was born in Richmond, Virginia. I was adopted. So I don't know biologically if any kind of alcoholism runs through my family, but the house I was raised in, there was no alcohol. My dad was a Baptist minister, and my mother was actually the more strict and religious one in the family. My dad was very understanding. My dad was more spiritual, and my mother was more religious. But I was, you know, raised with that czar of the heaven. I was raised with that punishing God, and I was raised to go to church every Sunday, every Wednesday, every function, every homecoming. And I was raised, you know, that the preacher's child has to act a certain way, look a certain way, and be a certain way. And I didn't feel that way. You know, I never felt like I was good enough, or I never felt like I could ever live up. And all the expectations were in my own head. You know, they were, you know, people were saying things to me, but I was hearing something else. And so I started, you know, living in a pretend only child world, you know, really early on. And I tell people, you know, I was a big fat liar long before I picked up a drink. I was dishonest because I didn't want you to see the real me. I can remember the first lie I ever told, and it was to get something I wanted. And it worked. So I kept doing it. And if I didn't get caught, I didn't think there was anything really wrong with that. So from, you know, I was deceptive. I was rebellious. outwardly. My mother had a certain idea of what, you know, she wanted her little only, her little girl to be like, and I wasn't fitting that mold. And the harder she tried to move me in a direction, the harder I fought. It caused a lot of friction. Now, they were great. My parents were wonderful. There was no abuse. There was no, no tumultuous, any of that. All the rebellion was only in my own mind. You know, I was always from the beginning a daddy's girl. If mama said no, I'm going straight to daddy. So I learned how to manipulate and play both ends to the middle, you know, super early too. And that served me well all the way through my drinking career. But I did, you know, I was okay in school, and I mean, I never really had any ambition. I was never one of those children that knew exactly what they wanted to be. I used to love horses, and the only thing I can ever remember wanting to be any kind of career was a jockey. So when I grew over 4'10", my dream just died. And I never really replaced that with anything. So I was aimless and I was a drifter. And you know, I was seeking comfort, and I wasn't finding it in the Sunday school. You know, and I wasn't finding it in my peer groups. So I just kept searching for something. You know, I didn't know. The big book calls it irritable, restless, and discontent, but I couldn't put words on that at, you know, 8, 9, 10, 11. I didn't know how to verbalize that. I just knew that I didn't feel comfortable in my own skin. So I didn't take a drink, you know. Got through elementary school, got through middle school. I started being attracted to the kind of you know, deviant crowd, smoking cigarettes, skipping school, toilet paper in the bathroom, you know, I was shoplifting, all that kind of stuff. But there was no real ready alcohol available. I really didn't have my first opportunity to drink until I was 15. I was in high school. And by this time, you know, my dad was not only a minister, he was also a school teacher. And so I went to Hermitage High School, and he taught at Henrico High School. But the county was fairly small, so a lot of the teachers knew, oh, you're Bob's daughter. Oh, you're Bob's daughter. You know, that kind of, you know, left eyebrow going up thing. And I couldn't pretend anymore. I couldn't pretend to be the good student. I couldn't, you know, pretend to be the obedient child. I was just out there. But by this time, my mother had opened up her own travel business, which had become a direct result of her organizing trips for the church. You know, she was very involved in the church, so there were a lot of older people in her church, and she felt like she could be helpful to them. She could be of service to them, really, by helping them, you know, plan prepackaged bus tours. And that was in the 70s. Well, by the 80s, it had kind of boomed, and she had started her own business. So my first drink happened. We were on a tour. We were on a cruise ship to Alaska. And if anybody knows, there is no, at least in the 80s, there was no drinking age on a cruise ship. If you could order a drink, or if you could see above the bar, they were going to serve you. And you also didn't need any money. You could charge everything to the room. So I got with the other little teenagers running around the cruise ship and started ordering what they were ordering. Jack and Cokes, Tom Collins. Somebody had a fifth of Jim Beam sent to the room. I mean, and I hear people talk about, you know, people taking the first drink and they get that. I didn't get that. I got that feeling of relief I felt accepted by these people. I felt like I fit in. You know, I felt like I finally found my crowd, and I associated it with alcohol. Yeah. So I got in a little bit of trouble when the bill came in and all these drinks, you know, they were like $5.95, and it was probably $200 of a liquor on my parents' room bill. And I can remember my mom going, "What is this?" And I'm like, "What? They're just fancy names. I wasn't drinking." And again, the lie, and for some reason she believed me. But when we got back from that summer, I went into my junior year of high school. I didn't want to let that go. And I began to discover the ease and comfort that a drink brings. And I began to seek it out very actively. And I don't know, I never really had a moral compass. I was raised with right and wrong, but I would know something was wrong and deliberately do it anyway if it satisfied my own needs. I was so selfish and so self-centered. I didn't care who I hurt, what I did, what law I broke, what trouble I was going to get into at school, as long as I got what I wanted in the end. And that had to do with, cheating, grades, booze, extracurricular activities. It didn't matter. And my parents were horrified. They started taking me to counselors, and I became very skilled at telling them what they wanted to hear. And, I just perfected being the actor on the stage, putting that game face on when I got ready to go in there, knowing that I had to say certain things and act a certain way so I could get away with it one more time. And it just kept going. And I came home from school. It's the end of my junior year. And both of my parents' cars were home, which was very unusual because my mom worked very long hours at the office, and my dad oftentimes didn't get home from school till after 5 o'clock. And I don't know if I was, I don't remember. I just remember being shocked and horrified, and I immediately made it about me. I'm like, oh my God, I'm in trouble. They're here to, get on me about something. I remember going to the house and just feeling, I don't even remember what I've done. And they called me upstairs to my parents' bedroom, and I went up there. My mom was laying on the bed, and my dad was sitting on the bed with her, and he goes, we need to talk to you. And I said, what? And they said, we need to tell you something. Your mom is sick. She has cancer, and we're going to get through this, and you can't tell anybody. And I said, what? Because I'm ready to get blasted for something. And when I realized that that wasn't it, it took me a minute to register. What had happened was, and I didn't find this out until after my mom passed, what had happened was my mom had suspected that she was sick for a long time, and she had gone to her doctor, and her doctor had kept putting her off and saying, oh, May, it's okay. That's probably just a calcium deposit. Oh, May, you're fine. You're just working too much. You're overworked. You're stressed. That's why you're losing weight. And then finally, when they did do the blood test, when they did do the biopsy, it was fairly late stage in inner lymph nodes, and she didn't tell my dad any of this. She didn't tell my dad. She didn't tell her sister. She didn't tell her own mother. She didn't tell anybody. She shouldered this burden by herself because she didn't want anybody to feel sorry for her. So when she decided to go ahead and seek treatment and go through chemo, it became the big secret. And that was the kind of environment that I was raised in. The stiff upper lip, we keep it in the house. We solve this. We are self-reliant. We are family-reliant, But I was raised in a godly family. Where was God in all this? I was really confused, not to mention getting really drunk. So coupled with all of that was just fuel for my alcoholism and my selfishness. Because I was too involved in what was going on in my own little world to be available for my mother. At that point, I could not set aside what I had discovered that gave me some kind of relief to be of service to her. So I continued on. And my illness and her illness progressed. And she continued. My mom was a fighter, and she continued to live. And I ended up I don't know how I graduated from high school, but I graduated from high school. I get into college. I was accepted at VCU. I'm not really sure how that was done either. I still think my mom and dad pulled some kind of strings that they knew somebody down there. And college there was a total washout. It was just complete permission for me to, continue to drink and to do other things. And I was completely lost in the lifestyle. I wouldn't come home for days. I was going to school but living at home. But I wouldn't come home for days. I wouldn't call. You know, my mantra was, you know, when I would show up, I would be just like, leave me alone. Just leave me alone. You've got your own problems. Let me deal with mine. And I was just angry and defiant. And finally, they decided to put me out of the house. They're like, hey, we're done with you. And I begged and I wheedled and I said, well, what do I have to do? They said, well, you need to do something about your drinking because we can't have you running the streets like that. So I went to my first treatment center only to keep a roof over my head. And I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1989, in December of 1989. And it was in December. And it was in Cartersville, Virginia. And it had snowed early. And I remember driving out there, and it was beautiful. The fields were covered in snow. You know, they had plowed the roads, so the snow had built up on the other side. And I remember going down, like, where's the treatment center? Where am I going? You know, I'm in the middle of nowhere. We pulled up, and it was this old, dilapidated farmhouse with a trailer in the back. And I said, oh, I'm not staying here. And my dad said, get out. Get out of the car. You know, he said, get in the car. And AA did. He said, get out of the car. I said, I don't want to go. I won't drink anymore. I won't. And he said, get out. So I got out. And I don't remember. I mean, they had AA meetings there, and I was introduced to AA. I don't remember much about it. But I do remember at some point in those 28 days where I got an inkling that maybe I do have a problem. But I would look at the other clients and say, but I'm not that bad. For God's sake, I'm only 20 years old. You want me to stop? Are you kidding me? Drinking? I'm not even legal to drink yet. You want me to stop? But that seed was planted in my mind that maybe it is the booze. Maybe it is all that stuff. Maybe that is a problem. And I dismissed it. So I was smoking banana peels in the bathroom. I didn't even give that a wink and a nod. I think I might have gone to one or two AA meetings, and my parents did try Al-Anon, and they liked it. I didn't like that they liked it, but they liked it. So I had to become much more deceptive, and it put me even deeper, and I eventually had to leave the house. So I didn't change. I just had to change where I was so I could keep doing what I was doing. Leave me alone, but still pay for my bills. So bad. And I ended up doing a geographic cure. This is good. I decided I was going to cure my alcoholism. The answer was I had friends in New Orleans. And that was going to be the answer to my shift. I had just turned 21, and I could get a job in a bar. I mean, it was great. It was freaking fantastic. And it was. I learned how to do the morning drink. I learned how to drink 24 hours around the clock. I learned that if you added things into alcoholism, you could drink longer, you know. I learned what it was to come out of a blackout and just keep going without a blink of an eye. I mean, they taught me all kinds of stuff. And everybody was drinking. It wasn't, I felt like a rookie from where here, you know, in Richmond. You know, I was like the slosh queen or something. I was like, this is great. They're much worse than I am. I told you I didn't have a problem. So, needless to say, that is not an answer. But what happened was I ended up being arrested down there, November 16th, 1990. They came and arrested me for things that I had done in Richmond that I thought that I had neatly ducked and dodged and got out of, but I didn't. And so I got to have my very first trip to jail in Orleans Parish Prison, and it was not nice. And I thought I was just going to be in there like just a few hours until they could just kind of rotate me out and just bond. I'd seen it on TV, and yeah, it doesn't work that way when you're arrested in another state, from another state. I ended up being held down there for 90 days and then brought back in a little four-seater Cub plane in shackles back to Richmond, and spending the next several months in the Richmond City Jail. And the what happened with that was, I don't even think I thought much about it. It was just another day in the lifestyle, you know? People I knew had been arrested. I got to get arrested in another state. It was almost like a badge of honor, and much to my parents' shame. So when I was released, my drinking didn't even slow up. A matter of fact, I congratulated myself and said this out loud at bars of just being, I'm just going to be a pure alcoholic now. And I patted myself on the back because I was able to maintain employment. I was able to go back to school. I was able to have some kind of, you know, semblance of a life, all while drinking because of everything I'd learned in New Orleans. And so my mom was very, very sick, and I was actually, she chose to come home to die. She didn't want to do any more of the treatment and all. She had managed to live almost 7 years after she was diagnosed. So she came home. So I was able to be there when she died. But I was not grieving or even considering any kind of remorse. The guilt and the shame that I felt over the way I treated my mother was horrendous. But I pushed it down. I pushed it down and I pushed it down. And I just kept going. And I kept going. That was, you know, in August of 1992. And the 90s and most of the 2000s are a big blur of, you know, drunkenness, spots of incarceration, quite a few treatment centers. I got to know Henrico County Mental Health very well, but I just kept going. And I would have periods where I was dry, but I wanted nothing to do with Alcoholics Anonymous, and there was no God in my life. And my dad would beg me, please come to church with me, Sherry, please. And I would drive him to church. I would drop him off at church. I would drive around the block while I waited for him to come out of church. But that is what I associated God with, and I didn't want anything to do with it. Because if a woman like my mother had to suffer the way she did, and she still, you know, all that, all those old ideas were going through my head. I didn't want anything to do with it. So I just kept going. And I used to make fun of Alcoholics Anonymous. I used to, a man that was friends with my dad gave me a big book. And I remember I used to sit in my bathroom and I would read the stories in the back. But I would only read the part where the people were like getting drunk. And once they started to recover, I would stop reading it. Because I couldn't relate to any kind of recovery because I just wasn't ready. I just thought I could figure it all out. I thought I could figure out how to manage and control my drinking. And I clearly couldn't. So my dad got very sick in 2005, and I moved back home. And I had had spots where, you know, I would manage to hold it together and have jobs and be self-supporting, but it was very brief, very fleeting, and very alcoholic. So I moved back home to be his primary caregiver in June of 2005, and it was pretty bad. I didn't have any more friends. You know, you got to remember, I started drinking so I could have a social center. I was completely isolated. I wasn't drinking for the effect anymore. I wasn't drinking for ease and comfort anymore. I was just drinking to be unconscious. And I was just drinking against my will. I was drinking because I have an allergy to alcohol. And when I start, I cannot stop. When I wake up in the morning, the first thing I thought about was, is there anything in the house? How much money do I have? And I wonder if I can get a ride to the store. I wonder if Daddy will let me have the truck. Every single day. And somewhere in that summer and fall, I had a very brief moment of clarity where God touched me on my shoulder and said, enough is enough. You're done. You know, you're not going to die the way you think you're going to die. You're going to live in this hell of misery and continuous same thing day after day unless you do something. And I knew a lady that I had met through all my treatments and incarcerations and everything, and I knew that she could help me. So I called her up, and for the first time I told somebody the truth. And I said, I don't want to live like this anymore. And she said, I'm so glad you called. She said, I will help you. Come in. So she put me into what I hope is my last treatment center. It was the first treatment center, and hopefully it was the last treatment center. It was Willow Oaks, and I went in, and again, December, it was 2005, and I was released in 2006. And you remember my sobriety date is November 2007, so I had another little interlude. But in January of 2006, I was introduced to my first sponsor. And came out to the treatment center, had a meeting going on out there, and I was very, very taken. He was very, you know, charismatic and very different from the other people that came out there. And he talked about the book, talked about the big book. He could quote the big book. He talked about God in a way I had never heard. And he made it all very real. And he made it all very human. He made it seem like it was okay to make mistakes. He made it seem like it was okay to make mistakes in Alcoholics Anonymous. And something about that made me ask him for his phone number. When I got out, I called him. And I said, will you be my sponsor? And he said, asked me the question, are you willing to go to any lengths to stay sober? And I said, yes. So began my journey. I went line by line, page by page through the big book with him all the way up to the fourth step. And I stayed sober, and I got right in the middle. I mean, I got service positions, I was fellowshipping, I was reading the book, you know, I was looking good. And I decided that it would also be very complimentary to my recovery if I had a partner. And so I started looking around the rooms, and I picked one out. Boy, he was really handsome. And he had many, many years of sobriety. Okay, it didn't occur to me that he really shouldn't be hitting on a newcomer. I just blacked that out. So I was very excited, so I went and told my sponsor. I said, you know what? I said, guess what? I said, I'm going on a date. Look, and Joe's whole face went like this, like, oh, God. He was very dramatic. He's like, what do you mean you're going on a date? And so I went, I was like, he goes, you didn't tell me any of this? Is he even lying to your sponsor? And I'm like, lying? I just didn't tell you. He says, that's lying to your sponsor. He says, I cannot tell you what to do. As your job as a sponsor, I work the steps with you. I can tell you what I've done. I can tell you what my experiences is. And I can tell you what other people's experience are. And their experience has not been good in relationships at 7 months sober. Not a good idea. But you can do whatever you want. So I did. And it did not end well. It ended up with me, I think I had like 363 days of sobriety or something, and I decided that it would be a good idea to take a drink. Because in a relationship, I had isolated myself from everything that was keeping me sober, especially God. I had stopped relying on God, and I had stopped listening to you people. I had stopped showing up for service positions. I had taken out committed meetings during my week. You know, he needed me. I had a disabled daughter. I mean, family. My dad had gotten sick. I had to be available for my dad. All these things started to get in the way, you know, of my life, my big, brand new, sober life. And I woke up one morning and I was freaking miserable. The heebie-jeebies were all over me. And I knew exactly what would take care of it. And I didn't drink that day. I remember driving around Richmond, gripping the steering wheel, praying serenity prayer. God, grant me serenity to accept things I cannot change. You know, just dying and not telling anybody. Telling myself that these people don't want to hear about my relationship issues. Just be quiet. You can figure it out. It'll be okay. You're praying. I mean, it's insane when I actually say it out loud. Of course I drank. Of course I did. I'm an alcoholic. You know, if I'm not working the steps, if I'm not seeking a spiritual solution, if I'm not, you know, trying to change the way I think actively every day, you know, maintaining my spiritual condition, of course I'm going to get drunk. Of course I'm going to want to. And so I did. And I didn't tell anybody, you know, because I didn't think anybody would find out. But guess what? When I take a drink, I have to take another one, and another one, and another one, and another one. So, of course, people found out. Of course, he found out. Of course, Rhett found out. And he joined me. He said, oh, what a great idea. We can be drunk together. I mean, that's not what he said, but that's what happened. So from about March of 2006 to November, I mean, March of 2007 to November of 2007, I stayed obliterated. But the difference between the two of us, when I get drunk, I go to any lengths to get what I want. And that includes breaking the law. Rhett can have, you know, managed to, you know, maintain for a little while. My alcoholism had far exceeded his. You know, it picks up right where you leave off. And so while I'm out there running around doing things that the state of Virginia frowns on, you know, he's sitting in the living room, you know, with a highball making it look okay, you know, drinking with impunity. So I got arrested one more time. And he was devastated. My dad was devastated. He was devastated. I was pretty devastated. And he decided to stick by me. And when I got locked up, you'd think that would change me. But when the door slammed shut, I started to seek out things in there to change the way I feel. I couldn't get a bottle, but I could get other things. And I continued that behavior of not seeking God, but seeking something to change the way I feel. A chemical. That's sick. You know, you're locked up and you're still trying to get high. Still trying to escape. Still, Sandy Beach says it best, you know, you're given the answer, and we agnostics, you know, you're given two choices. Here, take a spiritual solution or take the door to, you know, hell, misery, and death. And I had to think about it, you know, and I was actually choosing the door of hell, misery, and death, you know, instead of seeking the spiritual solution. I thought my life was over. But for some reason, on the morning of November the 20th, I woke up and I was exhausted. Because you want to know how hard it is to get a drink out here when you don't have any money? Imagine how hard it is to change the way you feel when you're behind bars with no money. I was exhausted. I'd been doing it for quite a few weeks. And I just gave up. And somewhere in me, I said, God, I can't do this anymore. God, can you help me? Please, God, please, please help me. I am so tired. And I decided to call Joe, my sponsor, collect. And he answered the phone. He accepted my call and he answered the phone. And he said, well, are you ready to work the steps? Are you ready to go to any length to seek victory over alcohol? And I'm like, I absolutely am. And he said, okay, let's do it, you know. So I started calling him while I had to go through some court and legality. With my record, I don't really know why I'm standing here in front of you today, a free woman, because if life was fair, I would still be in prison. But, you know, God saw fit that I was able to serve some time and to do some time in like a drug treatment facility halfway thing. I mean, I don't even know what to call it. It's not really treatment. It's not really jail. But it is somewhere in between. And, yeah, right, something like that. And, but I was still incarcerated. I still had to answer to the court. So I did that. But, you know, Joe came to see me every week. I called him. I tried to renew the connections that I had made with AA in that year. But I still tried to maintain contact with the boy, with Rhett, because I still thought that he was part of the solution. And it was a while. It was some months before my thinking became, because when I came in, I couldn't even put sentences together. You know, I couldn't read. You know, Joe would want me to read things in the book and write about it, and I couldn't do it. I had to have somebody to help me. I had to start asking for help. And God put people in my life all along the way that helped me with that. You know, I got to go to AA meeting while I was in there, and I got to meet a woman that's still a very big part of my life now, Sammy. And she made the big book come alive. You know, I'm, you know, Joe is my sponsor, but I was able to have face to face. I was able to do a fourth and a fifth step, finally. I was able to understand about what turning my life and my will, my thinking and my actions are over to the care of God. And it came real clear. I would call Joe and I'd be like, I'm so upset. I don't understand. My dad's not doing this and my dad's really sick and these people are mean to me. And he'd say, stop, 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 stop. He said, did you ask God about it? I'd be like, no, I'm asking you. You know, God doesn't give me a direct answer. And he would hang up. He'd say, ask God about it. And go, click. And I get so pissed. But the first time that I was, you know, so tumultuous in my head and I turned to God in prayer first, and waited a second, and then I called Joe, I realized, oh, that's the third step. Oh, I'm asking God about it. I'm not looking for a human power to answer my questions and give me a solution. You know, I hear God's voice in y'all, but I have to ask first. I have to take it to God in prayer first, you know, before I can actually hear the answer. So, I did my first fourth step. I did my first fifth step. Six and seven, my defects of character, my dishonesty was so glaring. My expectations, my judgment, my self-seeking, which is directly tied to my dishonesty, because you've got to see me a certain way. You know, I've got, a reputation to keep up or something. Even in my drinking, I wanted you to see me as, you know, a certain type of drinker. When I first came back into AA, I wanted you to see me as the worst drunk in the world. You know, I would exaggerate some things so you would see me a certain way. I was so self-seeking. So self-seeking at work. I would want to elicit a result from my boss. So I would act a certain way, not out of the pure joy of being able, you know, to serve at my work, but because I wanted you to treat me a certain way. So self-seeking. God revealed these things. The amends. I can't tell you when I first started to talk about my family and you know, share my story, I would tell people, I don't have any family. My mom died. My father ended up passing away in March of 2010. I would say, I don't have any family. Well, through the amends process, you know, I have been able to reconnect with one of my first cousins and my mom's sister. You know, I wouldn't even acknowledge that they existed. That's how deep that resentment was. But I, through God's eyes, I was able to see how inconsiderate and how selfish I was in that family. And I was able to sit down and have dinner with her not all that long ago. I made an amends in a PetSmart one time to my very first boyfriend. I mean, it was on my list. It was my intention. I couldn't find him anywhere. And I'm sitting there making a tag for my cat one day, and he taps me on the shoulder and said, Sherry Gallier. I said, oh, my God. You know. And I didn't know if I would ever have that opportunity again. So I made an amends and a PetSmart. You know, I don't, it's God's time. It wasn't mine. And one of the things I will say also about the amends process, you know, it's how I fit myself to be a maximum service to God and the universe. It's not about me feeling better. It's not about me absolving myself for the guilt and the shame of the way I treated my family. When my dad was dying, my first instinct was go to his bedside and, like, just spew everything. You know, say I was sorry and try to make up for what a horrible daughter I was. Thank God Joe stopped me and said, Sherry, that's not what it's about. You cannot, you know, ease yourself of that guilt. That is not an amends. He says, you make your amends to your father, you go and be of service. You go and hold his hand, make sure his lips are wet, you know, and take care of him. You're not going to go in there. That's not an amends. That's harming him. When the book says could, you know, injure them or others, there's an example of that, and that's what he told me. He said, no. He said, you just be of service to your father the best way you can. That is your amends, and you will continue to do that in any way, form, or fashion you can for the rest of your life. And, you know, and I put some things out in the universe because I was not able to make amends to my mother. was not able to make amends to my grandmother, you know, or my aunt or my uncle. I have to make living amends. I have to treat every single person like they might be that person. The 10th and the 11th and the 12th step, you know, I have pretty good with my prayer and meditation in the morning. I need to shore it up a little bit at night, you know. I don't like to look at my day. I don't like to look at my debit ledger of the day, you know. I get kind of sleepy when I think about all the things I could have done better that day, you know. Or a really good episode of Law and Order comes on right when I'm getting ready to, oh, you know, squirrel. I can't, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. So that is something I'm very aware of. But I have the privilege of sponsoring other women, and I have a sponsor now. My first sponsor I'm still in touch with moved out to Portland, Oregon, so I have a sponsor that's in Richmond, and I meet with her every Saturday night, and she was over at my house last night. She lives very close to me, so I either go to her house or she comes to my house. So she was over at my house last night, and I was talking. I said, you know what I realized, Meg? I said, I started out, you know, drinking so I could find a social set. I said, now I'm such an isolator. Alcohol has isolated me, you know, and it is very hard for me to come out of that. I am very content in my apartment with my cats and my books and my puzzles and my TV. Sponsee calls? Think I want to answer the phone right away? Sometimes, but sometimes not, you know? But I do it. I do it because I said I would go to any lengths for victory over alcohol, and I do it because somebody did it for me. And I do it because after I've talked to people, I get something out of that, you know? They give me a little nugget of wisdom I might not already know about. That has been the single hardest piece of my sobriety, is putting myself out there, fellowshipping, coming early to meetings, staying late to meetings, showing up, you know, making myself available to sponsorship. But I have had a really tough summer. I did some stuff in the springtime that was so self-will, and I paid for it. And the only thing that has really kept me going is doing something that goes against my nature, and that's putting myself out there. It's making myself available for other people in AA. And, you know, being of service. Always coming to my home group. You know, being active on the corrections committee, because, you know, somebody carried me the message behind the walls. And it's very important that I'm able to make sure that that message continues to get carried behind the walls. And I have started slowly to believe in my heart of hearts that it's not so much, you know, what I feel anymore. It's not important. It's what I do. You know, my thinking will fail me. I have to keep moving. I have to keep moving in the direction that God has pointed me in. And that is, you know, if I ever get stuck, I say, well, God, what would you have me be? You know, that's in the book. What would you have me be? And usually it's either, okay, you have to be kind, you have to be silent, you have to be of service, you have to be helpful. You know, these things will come to mind. And I might not do them right away, and I certainly don't do them perfectly, but I do them. I show up. And for someone that's as selfish and self-centered as I am, it's a miracle, you know. I couldn't do this. You know, no chemical could have done an entire psychic change. It only came from working the steps. Only came from, you know, being available for other people. It only came from when I started to tell the truth, when I stopped deceiving myself and trying to deceive you all. That's when God started to work the miracle in me. And I can't express the gratitude that I have that I'm able to be alive, because the man that I thought that I needed so much to complement my recovery, he ended up dying of this disease in November of 2013, and left, you know, behind a beautiful family, because The ego will kill me. My ego will tell me that I don't have a drinking problem. My ego will tell me that I don't need a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I get that message in all kinds of different ways, so I have an overwhelming gratitude to be sober. And I think that's where I'm going to end. Thank y'all.